Anna.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. Thanks so much for talking with us about this difficult. We have discussed the difficult relationship with your father before. The New York Post reported today that when he was sick with terminal cancer in the summer of 1979, he shot himself outside a Connecticut hotel.
Yeah.
Why have you never discussed this before?
You know, it's very painful for my family. You know, at that point, you know, we had all talked to him about his health. He had been a very heavy smoker for a long time. He had lung cancer, he had emphysema. You know, the cancer had metastasized. It was clear he didn't have much time left. He didn't give any indication that this is what he was going to choose to do, but, you know, we all knew the end was near one way or another. And, you know, it's just very painful because it's all the result of this horrible decline he went through, you know. And I think, you know, talking about it obviously just brings up what that whole long, painful period was like, but particularly the last, you know, year of his life was very, very difficult. And, you know, I just think I've tried to be open about the broad reality of my youth and what was going on in our family, but this particular piece is just particularly painful and difficult. And, you know, it wasn't something I felt real comfortable talking about, honestly.
I do want to go back to that time for just a moment. You were 18 years old that summer?
I had just turned 18, yeah.
How did you find out?
I don't remember the exact, you know, moment of phone call. I remember my mom telling me that we had to, you know, go to Connecticut really suddenly. But my memory is that the police called her. And, you know, we went down there. I remember very vividly, you know, not going in to identify the body. I just didn't feel up to that. My brother Stephen volunteered to do it. My mother certainly didn't feel up to it. You know, and it was it's kind of an unbelievable, incredibly difficult moment in life. You know, I think in one way or another, we all thought we would be saying goodbye in some more traditional way. And, you know, suddenly he was gone, but he was gone in such difficult circumstances over the course of years and years. It was just very, very hard to figure out. It's still hard to figure out to this day, but, I think, you know, what I remember that time was just there was this sudden emergency, and at the right time that my mom thought it was the moment to explain to me what was going on, she did. And I remember just waiting while my brother went to identify the body. It felt like a very, very long time and a very, you know, confusing time. But, you know, I think it also has to be understood against the backdrop of years and years of sort of things getting worse and worse. So on the one hand, it was a shock. On the other hand, it wasn't a shock at all that, you know, we knew his life was going to come to an end, and we didn't expect it to be this way, but we knew his life was going to come to an end, and there had been such sorrow around it, you know.
Was there a service?
There wasn't a traditional service. He had wanted to be cremated, and we did a little gathering back where we used to live in Connecticut and spread the ashes into Long Island Sound, where he was, you know, a place that he loved very much, and he used to sail and, you know, spend a lot of time there. So, you know, that was sort of we had an informal service in effect.
You've talked about how your father was largely out of your life after the time you were about 7 or 8 years old, when your parents divorced and split up. And so was it a difficult decade with him? Were you in touch throughout that decade? Was it near the end of his life when he found out he was sick that you were back in touch?
Well, we were in touch, but it was kind of sporadic. You know, from the time my parents divorced, first they separated, then they divorced. And I think the divorce was finalized in 1969, so I would have been 8. You know, I think that really is around the time his decline really intensified. And so maybe the first year or two after they separated, there was a little more normalcy in the sense of, obviously there were some holidays where we all got together, and you know, there were some times that I would see him and some attempt at some kind of schedule of me seeing him. But then it got just less and less tenable pretty quickly. And I remember, sort of particularly in the middle and late 70s, it was pretty rare to see him on certain holidays and maybe a few times in between. Would talk to him some on the phone, but you know, he was never far away. He always lived either in Massachusetts or Connecticut, so he was never far away, but it was, you know, he was just getting less and less able to handle things with each passing year. And you know, he was literally he was drunk pretty much every day, and so if I had anything to do with him, it was in the context of that. You know, some days a little less, or sometimes I would spend time with him earlier in the day when he was less drunk and you could have more of a conversation. But, it, you know, it was very painful that this was the consistent reality. He also smoked all the time, which obviously was the immediate, you know, path to his death. And, you know, there was a delusional quality. He would constantly say, you know, that he could stop whenever he wanted to, but he never could. And so, you know, that was... It's just very difficult to be around, and with every passing year, I think I felt less and less comfortable. I know, you know, my brothers felt the same way. It just was very hard to be around, and so, you know, it became less and less frequent.
I want to ask you about your emotional reaction to this, because when you've talked about this before, when you're asked about your father, you describe his service in World War II and how, like many veterans, he came back a changed man and with difficulties and alcoholism. And so it seems like you've sort of, you talk about it through the lens of policy in some ways, the larger picture. At the base, have you still carried around some anger?
Oh, I'm certain. Anger and sadness and very, very powerful personal lessons, you know, in terms of how to live life and what not to do, and you know, and a few things of what to do. I mean, I've talked very openly about this incredible juxtaposition of a guy who was a real hero. I mean, he volunteered to go to war, and he was in some of the most difficult, you know, bloodiest battles in history. Literally, Okinawa was one of the most horrible battles in the history of mankind, and he got all the way through that, and only lost his leg at the very, very end of the battle. And, you know, to have talked to him despite everything, despite all the pain and despite, you know, the times when he was drunk and everything, but to have heard him talk about that, and then, of course, for years and years tried to figure out after his death who he was, and spent a lot of time talking to my mother and my brothers and my aunts, everyone about him. You know, I think there was something very, very noble and very good about him, particularly when he was young. And I think the war had a lot to do with obscuring that or undermining that. And, you know, he didn't get sort of sick in every sense immediately. It all played out over quite a long period of time. And, you know, so I think for me, it's very personal. First, yes, it says a lot about the world, you know, when I talk to a wounded veteran, it's not an abstraction to me. I remember my father, you know, walking along with his crutches or hopping because he had not put on his artificial leg yet in the morning. And I remember, like, that was a commonplace that someone said to me once, you know, World War II came home to our house, you know, because that was forever after that. And so I think it makes me think about bigger things. It makes me think about mental health. It makes me think about substance abuse. It makes me think about what happens to wounded veterans. It makes me think about a lot of things, but mainly it's very, very personal, and it's tough stuff to make sense of to this day.
And I have to say, it does change for me a bit the story about your decision in your early 20s to start your public life with your mother's last name, not your father's last name. Was this a part of that?
Well, it started before. You know, I had made sort of the initial decision, even in senior year of high school that I was really starting to think about the name. And I asked, you know, I went to a high school, then there was a program within it that I went to, so I don't remember which document it was, but I asked for one of the diplomas or one of the certificates to have de Blasio put in as a middle name. And that was in May, and he didn't die until July. So I had already, you know, something was deep in me starting to feel like I really wanted to identify myself at least also with my mother's side. And that was really intensified from the time I went to see my grandfather's hometown, which was 1975, and sort of really started to understand that side of the family much more deeply and felt closer and closer to it. So it was growing over time. You know, so that experience was a very positive one when I went to Italy and connected with, you know, more and more of my mom's family. And, you know, it was very much the juxtaposition. It was very much like the antidote to so much of what I had seen in our nuclear family. And so my extended family became very, very important to me and my mom's side of the family, which was really, you know, a very strong and unified family on many levels, and you know, stuck together through thick and thin. And, you know, my father's family was more complicated, but and there weren't as many folks nearby and one thing or another. But really, I think from the time, you know, that I went to Italy, I connected more with my mother's side, and, you know, I found it to be this very positive, embracing family that sort of made up for everything we had gone through and was continuing to go through. And so, you know, I just gravitated more and more. And so by senior year, I was really starting to think about, you know, how to express that properly and starting to think about at least hyphenating the name.
Your identity as a father has been not only a central part of your campaign, but it's also clearly something that's quite important to you, and your relationship with your kids is something you talk about a lot. Did your kids know that your father killed himself?
Chiara did. Dante knew about his cancer. I don't think we had chosen to sort of go into a lot of detail about more than that.
What has this taught you about the stigma of suicide? I mean, you're a candidate for public office right now. This is also something you've carried with you privately for decades.
Well, you know, I think like everything else that kind of revolves around sensitive human realities in our culture, I think there's all sorts of stigmas that we're still dealing with. And it's, you know, I don't think it should be that way, but I do think it's still very much the reality. I think we've all been kind of surrounded by all sorts of stereotypes and negatives about people with problems and people with challenges. And so, you know, I think it comes down to, in so many ways, it's so easily misunderstood. And I think it's also, you know, just the whole thing was so painful that was also a reason not to, you know, get into it and dwell on it. And, you know, I think in some ways we all try to figure out how to make sense of the past and not let it, you know, weigh us down too much. And so I think what we ended up doing was sort of trying to acknowledge, especially, as I said, there was some real good stuff about this guy, especially before his problems overtook him, and sort of just leave it that there were some really good things, and then there were some real deep problems, and, you know, and we have to move forward.
I just want to ask you, and this is maybe too private, but did you have you had an opportunity today to talk to Dante?
Yes, I have, and you know, I think he's a very mature guy, and you know, I think he understood all this in the context of, it's unfortunate that these things become part of the public discourse. But again, you know, the larger story had already been told many times in our family about my father's troubles, and something we had talked about plenty in our family, in our immediate family. So I think it was it's difficult to talk about with him, but it's not a surprise to him on one level.
Is there anything else about this experience that you want to share?
Well, I really wanted to, you know, just answer questions with one person and then not, you know, come back to it. I think one thing I would say is that, you know, I think some things still need to be respected about families, and I think it's fair that I would sort of answer these questions for one person and explain the situation to one person, but after that I don't have any intention to talk about it anymore.
Okay, thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome.